Let's talk a little bit about the Social Capital Partnership. You launched it, I believe, almost exactly 5 years ago now.
5 years ago, yeah.
5 years. What's the state of the firm? You've raised 3 funds. How much have you deployed? And how is it going?
Well, it's interesting because, like, so we've raised 4 funds, billions under management, second fastest firm after Andreessen to get past that magical $1 billion mark. When you look at the portfolio quality, it's actually the best of every single VC in Silicon Valley. So, like, here's what I would tell you. Forget about us pitching you about social capital. Here's what I've realized about picking a good investor. There are, I think, 4 things that matter, and you should do your own diligence because these things are critical, especially when times are tough. The first is, are they good pickers? And there is now exceptional data from places like CB Insights and Mattermark where they will go and literally rank every single portfolio of every single venture capitalist to answer the question, is this a high growth portfolio or not? And I'll tell you why it matters. But that's number one. It matters because now success begets more success. You are then surrounded by a portfolio of other great exceptional leaders. As they learn things, they can pass them off to you. It's better to be within a group of winners. So it's better to be, you know, the 11th guy on the Warriors than it is to be the second guy on the 76ers. Always.
Or the first guy on the 76ers.
Even that.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. What I would say on portfolio quality, actually, 7 out of 10 companies are high growth companies according to those guys. We're number one in the entire industry. And I think what that means is we're good pickers. So the diligence that we do and the thoughtfulness that we take to understand people and their businesses, sometimes it takes us a little bit longer than we would like and maybe you would like, but I think we generally get to good answers. And even when the answer is it's not a good fit, we try to give as much feedback back to make it a fit, okay? That's the first thing. The second thing then that I think you need to look at is what is the percentage of that VC's portfolio that gets follow-on financing? And it's so crucial. So as an example, Sequoia has the single best percentage of getting A's financed to B's. The single best. Spark is second, we're third. And then everybody is a distant also-ran, and we are like 2 sigma above the industry average. Why is it important? So obviously, Sequoia has a fantastic brand. When they pick you, there's a bunch of folks out there that will give you the benefit of the doubt. Hugely important when you need to raise more capital. But then you have to ask yourself, well, what about from B to C? And there, what's interesting is Greylock is the best. We're the second best, and everybody else is a distant also-ran, and Sequoia is actually right below the industry average. So what does that say? What it says is, A, you have to construct and be good pickers, and then B, you have to help the portfolio companies in very specific ways so that you continue to get to that next tier of capital. It's not sufficient to just pick somebody because they can get you from the A to the B if from the B to the C you're just as fucked as everybody else. That doesn't work. And it's not sufficient to pick the wrong person in the A and then all of a sudden hope it's going to work out in the B. So it's really important that you're maximizing both those probabilities. So again, CB Insights, Mattermark, look at the data, multiply those 2 things together and rank them. And it's important for you because you cannot afford to be in a situation where in the absence of operational help, you could run out of oxygen accidentally. And then you want to have a situation where your venture investors have the benefit of the doubt with other investors. Because over a period of making enough good investments, they will say to you, all right, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt so that I can call in the 11th hour and say, listen, I know this is on the fence for you, but put in the $5 million. I'm telling you, we can help make it work. It matters, especially in times like this. And then the other 2 things, which I think are important to me personally, is number one is, are the people that you're working with mapping to what you are as a person? Whether it's your gender, race, ethnicity, which is more at this level, or whether it's your perspective and philosophy on how society and life should work. Because if you are going to be successful, I think it's really important that you pick people to bring along that are like you, so then that your values are then further reflected, because success begets success. And the last thing you want to do is create a successful person in someone you morally disagree with. And you do that by picking the wrong investor. So I think that's a really important one. Anyway, so like you put these all things together, I think we're doing well. It wasn't enough for us. And so we made the decision last year that we were going to migrate into not just being a venture firm, but being more of a company. And in building a company, our model looks very similar to what Berkshire has built or what Alphabet is building, which is basically, in our perspective, there is an opportunity to build a master brand in technology. Someone who has a really huge capital base, but a big vision around building things that create change in ways that we think are important. And the way that we frame our mission is, you know, what we are trying to do more than anybody else is to basically advance humanity by solving the world's hardest problems. And so we work backwards from what are those hard problems? Energy, healthcare, education, gender equality, whatever it is, and we try to find businesses that do that. We think that'll create a lot of capital and wealth, and it's important that then we control that versus somebody else who doesn't have that moral persuasion, because otherwise bad things happen. And so we have to basically reallocate that in constructive ways. So over time, we'll look like that. We'll look like a company with a huge amount of capital that invests, that builds, that buys, private companies, public companies, minority investments, majority takeouts.
Let's talk a little bit about diversity in the industry. You came out earlier this year. There was some sort of study about diversity at VC firms, which has been, how would you describe the diversity issue in venture capital?
This is really, really important. The gap between the entrepreneurial class and the investor classes has never been further, has never been wider. When you look around this room, the entrepreneurial classes are in general younger by nature, more socially liberal, more progressive. They've, you know, grown up in an environment where they believe fundamentally in gender and racial equality, in equality of sexual orientation, all these things that are just like key moral pillars of how we've all been raised. And the investor class comes from a very different ilk. So the gap is the biggest. Why is it important? It's important because of, I'll use a quote to explain this. There's a very famous family in banking, the Rothschild family. And this quote, which I now use all the time, is that Nathan Rothschild, who was one of the sort of patriarchs who, you know, financed a bunch of wars and blah, 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 one of the wealthiest people in the world at the time, says something to the effect of, you know, I care not on whose head the crown lies when the sun never sets. I care who controls the British money supply, because he who controls the British money supply controls the British Empire. I'm paraphrasing the quote, but you can find it. That is even more true today than it is then. And if you have the wrong people trapping and controlling wealth creation, productivity gains, we as a society are... Period, end of story, writ large. It speaks to the emergence of Bernie Sanders, it speaks to the emergence of Donald Trump, it speaks to Occupy Wall Street, it speaks to all of these things that are these fissures of inequality. So we owe it to ourselves to close the gap. The investor class should not stay where it is, and we should not be forced to go there. They should come to us. So how do we do it? At our firm, we've just taken a very simple point of view. My philosophy is, I just want to be around people that have gone through the struggles that I've gone through. I grew up, you know, it's funny. I was a little overweight. People called me a packy. I dealt with that for 15 years. I meet these amazing women. They talk about how they've felt, you know, maligned as they've tried to do. I see, like, you know, my other partner is a Pakistani Muslim, how what he's gone through. And I empathize with that. And it gives me energy because I'm like, these are the people that should win. I want to win with them. They should win. You should help them win. And then other people like them will feel better about winning and that it is possible to win. And then instead, you're not going to have the Koch brothers trapping $100 billion of wealth and all. Those days have to end. So for us, it's like... So you got to take a step, right? Step one, I have to construct a firm. I am so convinced we are going to crush it. We're going to destroy the established venture industry. They are so laggard and old and dead and white and male. And they should be listening not to what I'm saying, but to the clapping, because that's what really matters, because it's that validation that everybody else perceives it. And then in success, we are going to build an amazing organization of people that positively change the world in ways that create more equality. And we will reallocate and redistribute all of that success in dramatically fairer ways. And that is inspiring. I like that. And I want to see that. I met this like amazing guy, this African-American kid yesterday, and he's grinding. And I told him how it was like when I was grinding. And I said, we got to get you into a great company, because you got to put points on the board so that you can come back and work with us, so that when you're a partner at Social Capital and we put you in the field and say, go and make other entrepreneurs feel amazing and help them, he can do it with credibility. And then he wins. And then every other young African-American kid that grew up in inner city Detroit is like, I can be like that guy. I see that guy. He is me. See how important that is?
For sure.
So, yeah, that's what we're trying to do.
You invest in a couple of dozen companies a year, a dozen companies a year?
Well, it depends. Shark Tank is a lot more than that.
Right.
And then the rest of the world, probably 20.
Yeah. And so it's hard to keep track of all these things, but as anybody who's been in business with you knows, you respond on email, sometimes in minutes. I mean, you and I have had 30 back and forths and,
right.
You know, overnight or whatever. You're on a plane, I'm over here. And you're really into discussing it and hashing out stuff like that. How do you keep up with this incredible influx?
Just by doing it that way. Yeah. I mean, you know, I can be anywhere, anytime, and I just try to learn as much as I can. And, you know, I used to keep all those emails. I don't anymore,
yeah.
And it gave me a reference source. But it just allows me to think things through.
Right.
You know, to me, it's more efficient to do it via email because you have time to process. Whereas in a meeting, you feel that stress of let's get it done. There's time constraints, and sometimes there's better scenarios for meetings. But it just allows me to think things through and allows me to communicate with more people. And get
the
more
worst
done.
Thing you ever hear is, "Can you take coffee with me? Can you?
Yeah.
Can
I? Let's make a call. Let's get on a call. Yeah.
That's death.
Yeah, because I can't. There's not enough hours in the day.
Right. Yeah. No, I get about 20 requests a week for, can you set up lunch with Mark Cuban? I said, I've never had lunch with Mark Cuban, but I have had, you know, 1,000 emails back and forth. So now you took the opportunity to do Shark Tank.
Right.
After your fabulous performance on Dancing with the Stars. You were amazing. Now, you don't have to put yourself out there like that, but you do. Why did you take that opportunity to go on Shark Tank? And let's face it, that show, they weren't sure if that show was coming back.
Right.
I wasn't sure
that show was coming back.
It kind of sucked before you got on it, honestly.
It wasn't
honestly.
That bad, but it wasn't. It got
it
better,
wasn't good. It got better when you got on it. But what did they come to you and say, hey, the show's probably not going to make it, or
no,
we don't
I mean,
have you?
You knew something was up because they brought in guest sharks. Right.
Right.
And so I came as a guest shark, and literally I came in to do 3 episodes and I didn't think it would last.
Right.
Right. So I thought it'd just be a unique experience. Maybe I'll find a good business and it'll be fun. And those 3 episodes did well. And then they brought me back for another season, and the show is just taken off. It's just exploded. And you know, it's to me, it's not about getting access to the companies. That, you know, that's worked out actually fairly well for me. But what's amazing to me is that it is now the number one show on television watched by families together. And every day, multiple times a day often, parents will come up to me or kids will come up to me and say, we love the show. My 10-year-old talks about starting a business. My 11-year-old understands valuations. You know, we have discussions in my house about whether or not Mark or whoever the shark is going to invest in this, or who will, or would we do it. I mean, my 10-year-old comes up to me and is upset that one of her friends started a business before she did, you know?
Right.
And so just the whole idea of reinforcing the fact that the American dream is alive and well, that makes me feel good. That's why I do the show.
Well, I know you got a lot of fans in the audience of it. Now, they had a kind of a weird pay-to-play kind of idea when they started that show, which was, hey, we're producing a show. We should get 5% of all the companies because we gave you the opportunity. You found out about that, and what happened?
Well, what happened was I had a company that got an offer, right? And there's like, we're not going to be able to do anything because it's 5%. And I always kind of assumed, well, I'll talk them out of it. And they were like, no, we want to keep. Is that rain?
That is a torrential downpour, yeah.
Dang.
I think they get, yeah. We need it here in California. We had a crazy drought.
No, that's a good thing for California,
yeah.
I guess, yeah.
Wow.
Is there an ARC outside waiting for us, Jason?
This is the ARC.
We want one Google app. We want one Apple app. We want, yeah.
This is the ARC. We're all going to make it.
We're all going to make it, right?
So they wanted 5% for your 5 minutes on TV.
Either equity or a percentage of revenue, right, basically, or, okay, or net profits. And so I said, that's ridiculous, because we'll never have an exit on any company. You're never going to get any good companies. And I said last summer, I'm not coming back if it happens.
And they folded.
They caved.
They caved. Interesting.
Yeah, so it was, you know, thanks. So, yeah.
Makes sense.
And so now we're getting much better companies. But now our problem isn't getting better companies. Our problem is the gold diggers, right? Huh. There's companies that come in knowing that they don't want a deal. They price down the valuation to make it seem, they already raised money at a $10 million valuation, but they want $50,000 at a $1 million valuation, but they won't take a penny more, right? Because they just want to be able to get on the show, present the whole thing, and then walk away without a deal. And so now part of the sport of being a shark on the show is figuring out who the gold diggers are and just killing them, right?
Really?
Oh, yeah, you know.
So you make them take more and...
Well, no, it's not even that. It's just like you call them out on it.
Right.
You know, it's like you just came here. It hasn't aired yet, but there's one, and I don't know if it will air. And actually, I just retweeted. There's an article written in D Magazine where she was there observing when I just crushed these people on that topic. And I don't know when it airs. Or not all the pitches air. 25% of the pitches don't even air.
Right.
And so where I crushed them, where I said, you're just here, you know, you're a gold digger. You're just trying to get the PR. Because the reality is that the 10-minute... On Shark Tank, we don't know anything about them when they walk in the door, except their first names. And what might be a 10-minute pitch on TV could be 2 hours in real time, in real life. And then they and then they edit it down.
You'll have a 2-hour conversation with them?
Oh yeah, because if it's intense and there's a lot of back and forth, there's competition between the sharks, it's a good deal. We want to know as much as we can before we make a decision. But they'll come in, and these guys weren't looking for a deal. And so you're not here for a deal. You're just trying to get the PR. You know, there's no better place, not even the Amazon homepage, to sell product. This is the best place. 10 minutes, you'll sell more here than anywhere. And so I just crushed them, which I enjoyed.
Really excited about our first Fireside Chat. Aileen Lee, come on out. Aileen Lee is with Cowboy Ventures, and she's phenomenal. You all know. Give her a big round of applause. You sit this chair here.
Thank you.
Right here. Jed Katz is joining us as well from Javelin Venture Partners. We're in a couple of deals together. We've done incredible. And everybody is a huge fan of Hunter Walk. He's just such a great blogger and such a great supporter of entrepreneurs. Okay, thanks for coming, everybody.
So
as you probably heard. Yeah, it's a little awkward, right? It's a little too far away from each other. I feel like we're on the set of Gattaca or something. All right. People are in a little bit of a panic. We have choppy waters the last 6 months. Let's get that out of the way. Aileen, and by the way, it's Aileen, everybody, not Aileen.
Thank you.
Aileen. People call you Aileen all the time.
Yeah.
We're constantly correcting them. Are you going to invest more money this year, less money this year, or the same amount of money as you did last year? And what do you think the market holds for all these entrepreneurs?
Yep. So I think it is getting pretty tough out there for both follow-on rounds for existing companies, and then both, I think, cautiousness or hesitation on the part of seed investors to lean into what seems like we're still heading downwards. And so I think like the investor mentality for the most part right now, especially thinking about the first half of 2016, is like, maybe I'll hold my powder dry, see when things are going to bottom out, and then kind of start to invest when valuations have kind of settled out. So we meet with tons of companies every week, and we're kind of actually excited. I'm not excited about how tough it may be for some existing companies who have good businesses and good people and will do layoffs and really have to give hard looks at burn rates and other things. But I think for starting a company, I think get kind of the toughest, most missionary entrepreneurs with big ideas who know that it's going to take a long time to build a big company are going to be the ones who get funded this year and next year. And so I'm excited about that, and we'll be very active, I think.
Jed, yeah. Are you going to invest more, less, or the same in 2016? And your team must be talking about this.
Yeah, sure.
What is that strategy meeting like at Javelin? What do you guys do? You sit around and say, this is a great time for us to take advantage of lower valuations, or are you guys scared?
So I'll tell you a few things. We've seen some of the best deals we've seen in a long time just in the last couple months. I don't know if we're going to invest more or less this year, but we're probably going to put more into each company that we do invest in, because I think they have to make it a little further. They have to, you know, reach more milestones, be able to become that much more of an obvious yes for the Series B investors down the road.
Great. What's going on at Homebrew?
Yeah. So we typically make about 8 to 10 investments per year. We're playing a leadership role in a sort of institutional seed round. And whether the market is up or market is down, we try to make 8 to 10 investments a year. I think that one of the ways that early stage VCs can you know, sort of stab themselves to death is by trying to time market cycles. We're long-term investors. And because we're also institutionally backed, we have plenty of capital to follow on and support our companies ongoing. So for us, it's business as normal. I think there's certain verticals that maybe have gotten, you know, we're in the back end of innovation on those verticals, and you always have to be careful about investing into the back end of innovation. Maybe local consumer marketplace, on-demand services are being looked at a little bit differently. But at the same time, you have areas that are in the front end of innovation. We're doing a lot in the enterprise Internet of Things space, starting to look more at healthcare and biotech. So business as usual.
And what are you seeing inside each of your portfolio companies? Aileen, you mentioned before that, hey, belt-tightening layoffs. Is that across the board in your companies that everybody's saying, let's plan for the worst? Or are people just taking 10% to be cautious? What's the conversation like in these board meetings?
I think it's in between 10% and plan for the worst. So it's not 10%. It's like, you know, it has been actually. It's not just here. I think a lot of the companies that we work with started last year doing scenario planning, thinking like it's been really good, or we have product market fit. Maybe we should raise earlier than we were planning because it's a really good time to raise capital. So. Fortunately, we're working with a number of companies that have capital, but we're basically kind of like what Jed said. We're telling them, like, hey, maybe make it last longer than you were planning. We're having that conversation, or expect that the bar may be higher when you go out, and so plan that it's going to take longer, plan that you will have to accomplish more. Yep. And, you know, like, and internally, make sure you're setting the messages. It's a great time to kind of focus on maybe whittling priorities, focusing on culture and leadership and development, and really using this time as a time to make sure everyone is like really clear on the mission and why we're doing this, and the right people are around the table.
Is that similar for you, Jed?
Yeah, I'll add to that. The ones that raised a decent-sized round in the last 6 months are feeling really good that they did so. And they feel like they're in a great position, not just for themselves, but vis-a-vis their competitors.
Probably referring to Thumbtack.
That's one of them, yeah.
Yeah, which... we were both early investors in.
Yeah, Thumbtack, it's obviously they have a lot of cash in the bank. Their business is going well. They're feeling really good. Other companies are you know, watching their burn extremely carefully and making sure they can make it last a lot longer.
Look, you're an irresponsible investor if you're not having conversations with the companies in the portfolio that need to watch their burn. But I'd say on the flip side, you know, what nobody's talking about is, you know, there's a handful of companies that we're having conversations with to make sure they don't get too freaked out. Like, we don't want you to step on the brakes. We don't want you to change the plan. In fact, there might be an opportunity to put a little bit more capital in now and, you know, hire talent that's going to be set free from these companies. Take customers when your competitors aren't going to be innovating as quickly. So I think the message shouldn't be taken as it's scary out there. Everybody needs to cut, cut, cut. It's just, you know, where do you turn the dial from 1 to 10? I think there's companies that are, you know, accelerating into the uncertainty.
One thing that I've noticed is the deluge of high-quality companies that are being referred to me. In other words, companies that have product-market fit, they have some level of traction. I can't keep up with the number of amazing companies. These companies have more traction in some cases and more product-market fit than some of the unicorns we all invested in years ago, but we can't keep up with it. Are you having a similar experience that you're drowning in opportunities, Aileen?
I wish I was drowning in opportunity.
No?
I mean, I think one thing we do think about, and I don't mean to be like super doom and gloom, but I do think the exits are going to be much tougher in the next 5 years than they have been in the past 5 years. And so, like, the bar does continue to get raised. Like, before it was like get downloads or get engaged users, and now it's like get more, and now it's kind of like get monetization. But the next hurdle is like, what not obviously in the next 2 to 3 years if you're a young company, but especially in the consumer space, a lot of, like, you know, IPOs are, as we all know, being a public company is really challenging and more challenging than it was 10 years ago, and companies are waiting way longer to go public. And so, you know, the expectation has been that M&A and acquisitions will be the exit strategy for a lot of companies. And in the past 5 years, we've been living in a world where there were a lot of acquirers with very high valuations, so they could be very aggressive with acquiring companies at pretty high prices. And as those companies suffer challenges in their valuations, their interest, their appetite, and their currency, like, decreases significantly. And so I do think that, like, high-quality companies, product market fit, that's kind of, you know, the first block. But then the next block is also, even if you're thinking about investing in companies that are at that stage, you have to think about, like, how are the employees and the founders and the investors going to get have a liquidity event in the future? And I think that that's a more challenging thought process than it was before.
Yeah. Jason, to your point, look, some of the very best companies in the world were founded and funded during trying times, right? So I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but I think, yes, the innovation we're seeing at the seed stage right now is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Google, Facebook, Uber, these were all down market companies.
Yeah.
Chris, when you started, came into the angel investing space, we were kind of in this third wave of the internet, Web 1.0, Web 2.0, and you had had the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of brutal, was it not?
Yeah, I mean, most of the bets we had made no sense at the time. I mean, you and I are of that generation of people who got wiped out a couple of times. I mean, you know my own personal history. I was sent, you know, seven figures below zero in the crash of 2000. Dug my way back out to where I got back to zero finally and threw a party, a BYOMB party, because I didn't want to go back into the debt. But a lot of those bets we were making, I mean, I think Silicon Valley was a purer place during that downturn.
Yeah.
Because the posers were gone, right? So we didn't have a ton of business school grads. It wasn't sexy. Rent was affordable. Like, people just left, right? They took their U-Hauls one way and didn't come back. And so the people who are here were the true inevitable company builders who are going to be entrepreneurs no matter what.
Right.
Like, that's who is here. And so there was a self-selecting quality among the founders and among their startups back then that we don't necessarily have today. And I think that's why, if you look at a lot of the fantastic companies, you know, that are the fabled unicorns today, a lot of them came from that era when it was only the best and the hardest working and the most grinding entrepreneurs out there were left.
And let's talk about the grind and getting through those times. What do you think it is in entrepreneurs and athletes that gets them through those down moments, the moments where they're not able to achieve when things are sideways? I mean, did you have a point in your career, Tony, where you were not able to perform the 900s, the insane stuff you've done, where you were kind of in the negative zone?
Yeah, well, not just in terms of physical performance, but also in terms of business as well. I mean, there were times when I started our company, Birdhouse, in the first 3 years in, we were ready to give in. You know, the sales just weren't there. The interest wasn't there. And the same with my skating. Like, I was still improving my skills, but for no audience. So it was definitely difficult, but we embrace those challenges too, especially as athletes. I mean, someone poses a challenge to you and you have to figure out how to get over it. And so in doing that in my skating and also in the business, it was like, well, this is what's coming at us. We've got to figure out how to navigate this and how to succeed. And a lot of people just give up. And especially in skating, I mean, that's the first sign of someone that's going to be successful. It's no matter how successful they get, especially in competition, they continue to challenge themselves because they want to improve. Those are the guys that make it way further than anyone else.
Because you did hit the peak at a point and you had to come up with you really weren't competing against other people as much as yourself, correct?
Yeah, for sure, in competition. But that wasn't my drive. My drive was just to keep improving my skill, not how I fared compared to everyone else.
Yeah.
But I've talked to him about the fabled 900, right?
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah.
That was a legendary, like, to go 900 degrees, it's just something nobody else could do, et cetera. And when you talk to Tony or you talk to an athlete like that, I think the same thing you hear with when you talk to a startup founder, like, an Ever, a Zucker, you know, the Collisons or whoever you're talking to, you a Travis for sure. There's just an inevitability that they know that it's going to happen, right? So like, it's not a matter of like, oh gee, I hope someday I can do a 900. Yeah. You just know it's going to happen, and you know that every day you go out and keep pushing yourself and ringing your bell and falling and getting stronger, it's going to happen. And I think that's the one thing that sets apart our most valuable and high impact founders are, it's just not a matter of if this company succeeds. It's obviously going to succeed.
Right.
And they're the founders who interview you as an investor, and their whole thing is, why should I be giving up any of my equity to you? How are you going to make my remaining equity more valuable as a result?
Right.
And you're just like, oh, this guy's going, that's $100. But you're just like, this guy's going somewhere. I better jump on this train. I remember Kevin Systrom embodied that.
Like from Instagram fame.
Yeah. Who would have ever invested in photo sharing again back then? Right?
Yeah, it was like Flickr. We saw this movie.
We saw. I made money in Photo Bucket. Like, who was ever going to have lightning strike twice in photo sharing? So I was like, meh. And then as he started talking about, well, when we get to 75 million users, we're going to do this. And, you know, when it hits 200 million users, we'll have this kind of reach. We'll be able to do this kind of stuff. And by the end of it, I was just like, geez, take my money, man. Like, the guy was clearly going somewhere, even if I didn't believe in the underlying product as much as I should have in retrospect.
Today on the program, we have somebody who is both an entrepreneur and an investor, Anne Winblad, who you've been running Hummer Winblad for a long time now. It was 89 till now. You're going to be 99, 2009, 30-year anniversary coming up.
Yeah, it's 26 years.
It's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's really mind-blowing. You know, every time you think that you might actually have enough wisdom to make perfect picks, you realize that you've lost the venture capital handbook.
Right.
I'd love to be called just a capitalist, but that word venture looms large in what I do.
Now let's talk about this batting average on the first fund. 8 out of 16 went public?
Correct.
That's unprecedented, I guess. I don't know if that's ever been done before or done since.
Yeah, it was a pretty amazing fund.
What do you attribute that to?
Three things.
Yeah.
One is, it was a very prescient time for software. We were really going from the PC era to the client-server era. And so the new companies had an unfair competitive advantage, very much like today when we're dealing with enterprise software companies that have to deal with everything at web scale, billions of everything. So we see legacy vendors drifting behind and the new vendors ascending.
Right.
That's why San Francisco is so alive with enterprise software today. Number two is we really had every software company coming to us. We were the only venture firm 100% focused on software. So the quality of our deal flow was unbelievable. Mm. If we made bad picks, it was because we were lazy, and we weren't lazy, we were new.
Right.
We also were fresh off our own entrepreneurial backgrounds. John had been a venture capitalist for 4 years already with a small venture firm after he got his MBA at Stanford. And our third person, Mark Gorenberg, was an engineer out of Sun Microsystems. So we were very contemporary with the code. We really wanted to be super successful, and we had every company coming to us, and the industry was undergoing a massive change.
What did you miss? What's the anti-portfolio from that time? There's got to be something
we
that
call
you
those,
just grind your teeth about.
We call those sins of omission.
Sins of omission.
And
here we go.
I can remember one really really well. A wonderful guy in the Valley named Zvi Elon.
Zvi Elon, okay.
And Zvi, S-V-I, had a company called NetManage.
Okay, sure.
And he was selling basically commercialized TCP/IP over the phone. And he's a wonderful guy, smart, hardworking, and was unknown. And that's a quality we look for. We're not just finding pedigree. We're finding, you know, breakthrough talent. And we made a big mistake that we didn't make later. And Svi, every time we talked to Svi, we bonded with him. He liked us. We liked him. We were a perfect pairing of a team to work together to help create a company. When I said we do 16 to 20 companies, we look for fit as well. And we told Svi no. And we told Svi no three times.
Wow.
He kept coming back. He said, Ann, John, Mark, I've got a term sheet, but I really want you. We said no.
Wow.
We called up Sun Microsystems, a big company at the time, and said, hey, this TCP/IP thing. And they said, we've got 40 engineers working on that. We're going to own this. We called Microsoft. They said, we've got 50 engineers working on this. We're going to own this. We called IBM. They said, we've got 80 engineers working on this. We're going to own this. So we called Svi back and said, hey, the whole world, you know, this, it's way too competitive there. What we learned is the following. Svi had it done. He was selling this stuff like hotcakes. We would go visit him in his office about the size of this desk. And he'd go, wait, I got to check this phone call. It's another order. And slam it down and scribble down the, you know, type in the order.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, I got an incoming order here. And he'd just be sweaty by the end of the meeting from taking orders. So what we learned is that's exactly the time you should invest. When people have armies working on something and someone else already has it done.
Mm.
What turned out is that I think Sun, Microsoft, and IBM ended up licensing Svi's technology. Uh-huh. NetManage ultimately went public. It made its investors a ton of money. We could have had 9 out of 16 IPOs versus 8.
Yeah.
So that was a dramatic and great example of a learning and a sin of omission.
Yeah. And what have you learned as an investor is the key to success for entrepreneurs? Is there some signaling that you see now where you're like, hey, this person is difficult, that is going to serve them well, or this person is so difficult, it's going to work against them at some point? Do you have signaling that when you see it today, or do you try to not have signaling?
It's back to this venture handbook thing, is that when we do have a deal blow up, it is usually not because some competitor showed up or we misjudged market dynamics. That has happened, but not usually. Is usually the people have self-inflicted wounds.
Mm.
And we look for, sometimes we only find one person, very rarely, but frequently it's 2 to 10. And that ensemble really has to want to work together. And there has to be someone in that ensemble, even if they're not going to be the long-term CEO, who can get that company from Monday through Sunday, you know, in the takeoff phase.
Mm.
And it's also humble enough to know when they need to hire around them or above them, has enough hubris that they can lead the forces and, you know, declare victory when they make small victories, can keep their eyes on the tactical stuff while still realizing, hey, I have a strategy. That is really hard. Sometimes we get entrepreneurs who can do a lot of stuff, but they can't drive through a big strategy. So it really does amount to the right people matched to the right market opportunity at the right time.
What was the nature of those negotiations? I mean, because now the music industry seems to have a love-love relationship with you guys. Mm. They seem to love you most of the time. Once in a while, there's a flare-up. At that time, did they look at you as just like a bunch of dumb kids from Stockholm they could take money from, like just get some big advance payment from, or did they actually think that this would become a transformative company like it has?
I don't know, to be honest. I think one of the things that we did that was amazing was we were really, really adamant about people trying our product. So during this process, the 2.5 years, like we did all sorts of things to get them to use it. And in the cases where they didn't want to use it, we managed to figure out ways where their kids went to school and infiltrated their schools so that everyone in the school was using the product. Because, you know, that's, by the way, a great marketing tactic if you want to reach parents, is go through their kids. You know, we just got everyone around them to start using this, and eventually started building a peer pressure about this product is truly amazing. So I think half of it was, hey, we'll get some money. This probably will never fly, but it didn't matter because we got some money. And the other half was a real belief, like, holy, this may actually work. I mean, the rest of
the What was the investor reaction to it in the early days? You know, before you launched, who was the first investor or the first group of investors? What was the first valuation? How much did you raise back in 2007, 2008?
Yeah, so we were a little bit of an odd duck in the sense that we bootstrapped this ourselves, and we had money from before, so we ended up investing almost $10 million of our own money.
Oh, wow. And that's a good sign when you're an investor and you see the founders have put that much money to work.
Yeah, so we were both like serial entrepreneurs, which back at the time, you know, there weren't too many serial entrepreneurs in the Swedish ecosystem that had a couple of successes or had enough money to invest in your own thing. We never obviously thought that we'd have to invest as much money as we ended up having to do, kind of similar to the Elon example in the end.
Yeah, well, Elon went broke.
Yes.
He literally went to negative.
Yeah. We didn't go that far, but
In fact, he was living on a loan, according to what he said publicly.
Did you lend him the money? Or
I actually offered to.
Oh, really? That could have been an interesting one.
I was at dinner with him, and he was broke, and I said, I could loan you $1 million or $2 million. I don't have that much money, but I could loan you a couple of million. Yeah. He said, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I've got a loan for a couple of hundred, whatever. He had a loan from somebody very famous, I think, and he's talked about it publicly. But he went through $300 million to get SpaceX and Tesla there.
Yeah.
I said, what happened to the $300 million?
Yeah.
And he said, you see the two rockets that blew up? I said, yeah. He goes, that's a big portion of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you broke at the time, or did you still have a little bit left? How close did you get to the wire?
We were not in that position, and we didn't blow up $300 million. Not that we had $300 million
to
start
up,
with.
But yeah.
But
were you nervous that this wasn't going to work, and you had blown so much money of your own?
No, I wasn't. Again, I'd never really been motivated by money. That's not why I started stuff. So I didn't care too much about that. I cared a lot about our employees, because at the time, as we were building the product, as you do, like you find other great engineers or product people or people you want to bring on board in your company. And so by the time, you know, when we started doing the licensing, actually trying to get finalized, then we were about 40, 50 people working.
That's a lot of mouths to feed.
Yeah. So
it's a lot of weight, isn't it, as an entrepreneur to know that they all came to work on your vision?
Yeah.
And yeah. It's a lot of responsibility.
That was, to be honest, the toughest thing, like for us all throughout. Just there was so much belief. Everyone knew this was the product. And I kind of made the mistake. I mean, we got incredibly lucky that everything got sorted out, but I did a mistake, which I wouldn't do today again, which was I kind of shielded everyone from the whole licensing thing. And I think there was a pro and a con with that. The pro with it was that there was so many back and forths, like that, you know, I started having hair and then in the end of the process, I didn't have any hair. So I hate to burden someone else with that.
Yeah.
But the downside was, if things would have gone south, people, you know, had no idea that we were even.
Yeah,
like,
they could
really
have felt
close.
Betrayed that you didn't tell them.
Yeah, totally.
It is. This is one of the most challenging things as an entrepreneur, is that almost every company is on the verge of crashing and burning, even the big ones.
Yeah.
Because our industry moves so quick and so violently.
Yeah.
And if you're totally transparent, which you want to be.
Yeah.
You can make everybody, I don't know, just not be able to sleep at night.
Yeah.
And that's unfair too.
Yeah.
It's a hard decision to make.
Yeah, you got to find the right balance. But I clearly erred on the side of not being very transparent.
You let them also work, right? You let them do the work.
Yeah. But, you know, in hindsight, I realized that I got incredibly lucky because, you know, things turned out okay. So the things I had said for 2 years ended up happening. But I felt for a while that I was kind of repeating the same thing. Yeah, we'll figure out the licensing soon. Yet, obviously, we kept pushing the time.
There was a reputation at one point in time that Spotify was, like, not going to work because of the licensing. Mm-hmm. How close was it, in your estimation, percentage-wise, to working, like, at its worst, like to not working? At the darkest day, what did you think your chances were?
The darkest days, you know, we had a series of meeting in New York. It was about a week where it was pretty evident, like everyone just said, no, this isn't going to happen. Like, and don't come back. That was essentially,
really,
you know, yeah. So I called Martin up and I'm like, hey, you know, what's going on? And for those that don't know Martin, I will say that he's, you know, the guy just, he, it doesn't bother him at all. Like, none of that does. So he's just going to be, okay, well, that's totally fine. Let's go and do something else. So for him, he just listened to what I said, and it's like, okay, well, you know, that sounds stupid. But if that's the case, let's go and do something else. Give it another couple of weeks, and then we'll figure it out. And that was incredibly reassuring for me because, you know, I just felt like we had both invested so much of our time, money, had all these employees, and he was just totally unfazed by
what happened in those 3 or 4 weeks that made it turn around.
That's a very good question that I still wonder sometimes. You know, what I ended up doing is I just canceled my trip back home to Stockholm.
You ripped up the return ticket.
Yeah, and ended up camping out in front of their offices, coming back. I had to, like, tweak my messaging a little bit and twist things around, pay them a little bit more money, figure things around. But it just really turned. And then the other thing that I did, which really saved the company, was we wanted to launch worldwide day one. And I said, okay, screw it. Let's not do the U.S. Let's start in a territory where this doesn't matter as much to you. And right. Let me prove the model.
That was brilliant. That took the pressure off.
Yeah. And then everything turned around.
The merger with Time Warner is that still like a fresh wound for you? Because it seemed like it's...
No. Yes and no.
Because people made... It was the peak of this era that AOL, which people thought was just an online company, bought Time Warner, which was the storied, like, amazing movie studio,
right.
Magazines, everything. It's just, it didn't make sense. Was this the pinnacle of your deal-making ability, and was it like almost like you were just too good at making deals that you got this close? What was the story of this merger?
No, I have a whole chapter in the book.
Yeah.
I think there's some lessons.
Yeah.
The core of it was, you know, we had, you know, seen this significant increase in our valuation. I think that 2 years before the merger, the value of the company was $20 billion. 2 years later, it was $160 billion. So there was some financial diversification, having a broader, you know, series of businesses. Time Warner, I think, had $30 billion of revenue, $10 billion of profit across a whole platform of a portfolio.
And you guys had what at that time?
$5 billion of revenue, maybe $1 billion of profit.
Right.
And so we were able to merge and have end up with 55% of their combined company. And so that's from a financial standpoint, it makes sense. But also from a strategic standpoint, it makes sense. We needed a path to broadband. They owned the largest cable systems. They needed a path to the digital future because they were struggling to figure out how to...
You negotiated a deal with $1 billion in profits with a company with $10 billion, and you wound up with 55%.
Right. It was the right
Explain.
Deal. It was the right deal for us, and I think it was the right deal for
Clearly
them.
Clearly the right deal for the person who got 55%.
The lesson, though, and I talk about in the book, is that the idea of the merger, and even the things we talked about when we announced the merger, like digital music, this is years before Apple launched the iPod and some of the things with Netflix and YouTube were things that this company could have done, but it was unable to get organized to do it. And it's ultimately about people and culture and execution. And I cite in the book a Thomas Edison quote, "Vision with that execution is hallucination."
Right.
That sort of summarizes the merger for me. Yeah. I think it was a good idea. It was certainly good for our shareholders. It would have been good for Time Warner shareholders as well if we'd been able to execute against that and take what was the leading company in the internet and the leading company in the media, cable, telecommunications world and really invent the
future. It was the right idea. It was a great set of assets. Why were you not put in charge of all this? This was, to me, when I was in my 20s and I watched this whole thing go down, and I was like, Steve Case is going to be in charge of everything. Like, you at that point were the most powerful executive on the planet, but they put Jerry Levine in charge of this. And I said, this guy doesn't know this world. This guy's not a visionary. Who is this guy? How did he wind up in charge and not you?
Well, the simple answer is when I proposed the merger, I offered to step aside as CEO because I believed that it would be hard enough to get this deal done for the reason you mentioned, but it would be impossible if I was proposing that I take over the company. So on day one, in the first 30 seconds of talking to him about the potential merger, I said, if you agree to have a discussion about merging your companies, I would agree to step aside as CEO so you could run the combined company. The deal wouldn't have happened without that. And so it was a critical ingredient. I believed it was the right thing for AOL shareholders, so was willing to do that.
It had to be the right thing for AOL shareholders, because what people forget is you guys had this tremendous run, but then broadband came out,
And let's face it, you did not have the broadband assets. Right.
We did not have the broadband. And we even tried on the policy side to create sort of a dynamic around open access. The phone companies were required to open up their networks for narrowband dial-up. The cable companies were not. And so there was a real risk that AOL would kind of hit the wall as the transition to broadband happened. So there's a whole host of reasons why the merger made sense, which is why I agreed to step aside to facilitate the merger.
When you're watching it, though, in those years after, I think you have enough time that you can talk about it now without... Is it emotionally hard for you to reconcile
it? Not really. It's disappointing. No. It's frustrating. But I'm much more focused on the future. You know, much more focused on what we're doing now at Revolution.
I'd be so bitter.
I would be so bitter, Steve.
I would sit there and I would like break things because it was so perfectly teed up to be the company of the future. Was there like years of therapy or just you having to like take long walks on the beach to figure out, you know, why this thing collapsed and you weren't in charge? Be honest.
Not really. No, because I stepped aside, you know, 15 years ago, something like that. And most of the last 15 years, I've been investing through Revolution. And now nearly 100 entrepreneurs in a variety of sectors. One of the things I'm most enthusiastic about, and I devoted a chapter of the book, is this rise of the rest phenomenon. It's odd sitting here in San Francisco to talk about this. Yeah. But I think the next wave of entrepreneurship is not going to just be in San Francisco and not just in New York and not just in Boston. It's going to be all over the country. And there's already some evidence of that. And that's been our focus, is backing these cities and backing these entrepreneurs and trying to lift up entrepreneurship. So to me, it's not about relitigating the past. It's about kind of leaning into the future and trying to be positioned for the third wave, including with Revolution.
Yeah, you're a shark in that way. You don't look backwards. You got to keep moving forward.
Move forward.
But my God, I have to keep going back to it for a little bit. If you had
maybe
been
you need the therapy.
I do over this. I do. You know why? Because I feel like for a lot of us, we were so vested in this like story of convergence.
Right.
We all knew it was the right idea. And it was almost like this great story being told with AOL, you know, and Time Warner. And it was like, yes, somebody got there. They got the online asset and they got the brilliant Ted Leonsis, Steve Case. And now you finally have the music assets. You finally have the movie assets. You got the cable channels. You got the things. It's going to work. And it would have been Netflix and Napster and Facebook combined, a company for the ages.
Correct. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book, because the lesson around this innovation is not just applicable to, you know, what we were doing, you know, there or what other companies are doing now. It's in healthcare, in education, in food, in transportation. The leaders won't continue to lead unless they lean into the future, unless they figure out how to create the right culture internally so people really are focused on what's happening next. What happens as companies get larger is they shift from being the attacker to being the defender. Instead of imagining what's possible, they're more focused on protecting the downside. That happened as they all got larger, certainly happened after we merged with Time Warner. So what could have been great ended up not being. And part of that is, to me, the takeaway from that is it is about people, it is about culture, it is about execution, not just about vision, not just about opportunity. And that is going to be more challenging in this third wave because of some of the dynamics we've talked about. But the people get that right, whether it be the big companies who could get even bigger, not lose their way, or the small companies who could be the next giants. At the beginning of the second wave, as you said earlier, Facebook didn't exist, Twitter didn't exist, YouTube didn't exist. The iPod didn't exist. These things all were created in the second wave. There'll be a whole host of new innovators bringing fresh perspectives in the third wave and revolutionizing important aspects of our lives. But it's going to require this different mindset, more like the first wave mindset, less like the second wave mindset.
Do you miss being the operator? Do you miss being the guy?
I don't.
You don't.
I really don't. I get asked that a lot. No, I don't. I had a great run. I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun, and I learned a lot. But it's also fun to be backing the next generation of entrepreneurs across a lot of sectors. We invested in a lot of different sectors and a lot of different places. And to me, that's a lot of fun as well, trying to take do what we can to take these ideas and work with these entrepreneurs and really give them lift.
Yeah.
And also partnering more and more with investors in Silicon Valley and other places who understand this third wave is different and understand that some of the companies will not be here, but they'll be in these rise of the rest areas around the country. Understand policy is more important. The fact that we're sitting in Washington, D.C. and have a team that really understands the policy aspect of things, I think positions Revolution to really be where the puck is going. And that's a lot of fun. So in some ways, Revolution is my new startup. We've been working on it for a decade, and I hope a decade from now, it's viewed as the
you've invested in a ton of great companies and made a ton of money, but you had money It's in a way you kind of pulled a Jordan. Like you hit that like last shot that he hit versus Utah, whatever it was, and you walked off. You did the greatest merger of all time. You went out at the peak. I guess it's okay.
No, it was more than okay. It's a great man. And but instead of yeah, grew
is
up
there
in
a company you would is there a company you would actually go run if you like if there's no. somebody you get CEO offers? Do people come to you and say like, hey, you want to come run this company?
I do, but no, I'm running a company. It's called Revolution,
and it's a
company investing in lots of companies in a lot of places and a lot of sectors.
Is there a company you would run? Like if Steve Jobs had said, hey, you know, and when Steve Jobs left, if the Tim Cook said, listen, I can run this for a year, but I really need you, Steve. No. You want to come run Apple?
No.
No, you'd say no.
No.
You'd say no to running Apple.
First of all, you know, Tim is doing a great job. And you know, right.
Nothing that would get you off the bench to actually be an operator again.
Correct.
Wow.
Well, I think of myself as an operator because I think of myself both in terms of running Revolution and some of what we're doing that is different than other firms, both in terms of the places we invest and also the expertise we provide around partnerships and policy. I think that's interesting. I spent a lot of time on policy, particularly in D.C., trying to make sure we've got the right policies, such as the Jobs Act that I worked on a few years ago, legalizing crowdfunding, and how can we make sure we continue to win the global battle for talent. Things like immigration. I spend time on the Case Foundation, which my wife runs. We're involved in some issues around impact investing, inclusive entrepreneurship. I'm passionate about those things. So I have a great portfolio of activities that's a lot of fun.
Everybody knows the Roomba. Mm-hmm. Just to go down history here and go down memory lane, how did you come up with the first robot people are going to have in their house is going to be this little droid that zips around and cleans the floors? Why'd you pick that?
Well, we were doing lots of robots before that. We had been doing robots for 9 years when we started the Roomba development for all kinds of applications, from downhole oil to industrial cleaning to toys and games with Hasbro. But when we came up with the idea to do a Roomba, and then we started building them, and when we did the analysis, the price point worked, the capabilities worked, the customer focus groups worked, and everything just came together. And it's like, this is going to be the first real autonomous robot. And that's what got us so excited, because we're autonomous robot people.
So when you saw the first quadcopter in 2008, who had made it? Where did you see it? Because I don't actually know the history of who came up with this idea. I know I've seen the... there's an airplane that vertically lifts with two helicopter blades on it, and there's obviously helicopters. But when did the first person decide to have four? Because I think, was that the tipping point that you could say this is a quadcopter, this is a drone, as opposed to just a helicopter?
It's been going on in the universities. I mean, I remember seeing them in the early 2000s at universities, and probably before that. And the advantage is it gets rid of the swashplate on the helicopter, which can be finicky.
That's the blade on the back that's horizontal, vertical, not horizontal.
It's what lets you change direction on a helicopter by tipping the blade. The quadcopters, they don't tip the blade. They tip the whole vehicle. So that was the advantage. They're very easy to control. Now, we've actually gone beyond that.
Right.
We've created a hexacopter that doesn't need to tip to fly. So it's got all the advantages of the helicopter, but the ease of control of the quadrotors.
Got it. So it's a hexacopter, which means it has seven blades.
Six.
I'm kidding, six. I'm showing how bad I did in math. So it's an octocopter. It has six. No, it has six blades. So you picked six as opposed to four, why?
Well, what we've done is we put a dihedral, which is the angle between the base and the rotors, and a twist on each of them. And then with some fancy math running on the inside, you can achieve level flight. And you do need six to do that. But six have so many other advantages. If we lose a rotor, six can land. With our level-up technology, this robot can keep flying. If it loses one or some combination of two rotors in flight.
So it can actually survive losing an engine, perhaps even two.
Perhaps even two, depending on which two.
That's about to say, if two on the same side go out.
Not these two, but these two.
If the opposite two go out, you can probably land it.
Yeah.
So this redundancy makes it work. Now, why did quadcopters all of a sudden go from being dangerous and hard to fly to this year, I flew the DJI, whatever it is, Phantom, whatever, 2, whatever. And then I did the 3DR, latest one, with Chris Anderson out in Berkeley. And
boy, has everything changed, hasn't it? Like, you used to be, they have to train you in how to use it. Now, when I used it, it's just like up is up, down is down, left and right spins, and forward and back is forward and back.
Well, the typical,
it just works.